Hello and welcome to the second season of the Smart Power Podcast with Akash and Tal. It's been a month since we finished the first season and the response has been great from all parts of the world. Thank you for tuning in and listening to the podcast every week. This season, we are not sticking to a strict schedule. The episodes will be more free-flowing and based on country-focused current issues.
In today's episode, we will be talking about Kashmir, the past and present situation that has made Kashmir one of the high-profile violent conflict zones in Asia. Name and voice of our guest has been altered to protect the identity. In this episode, our guest is Bulbul, a Kashmiri who has on-the-ground experience and knowledge of the historical past and has shaped current events in Kashmir.
Hi, Bulbul. How are you?
Welcome to the Smart Power Podcast.
I'm fine as well.
We're great. How are you? To start off, not a lot of people even in India are familiar with Kashmir, the issues it faces and its history. Arguably, journalists themselves have some problems in delivering a neutral, objective perspective on Kashmir. And this is most likely because, again, not a lot of people are aware of the historical context of Kashmir. Can you tell us a little about the historic context
Kashmir,
of Kashmir?
To begin with, is a very ancient civilization. From among the civilizations of the Asian region, it can boast of a Neolithic civilization which goes as far back as 3000 BC. The remnants of this civilization are found in an area called the Burzuhan, and this area boasts of the earliest house-shaped dwellings in the region. Kashmir has seen a social, cultural, and religious shift from the first millennium to the 15th century, progressively giving way to Hinduism, Buddhism, and Islamic ideologies. The earliest inhabitants of Kashmir were snake worshippers called the Nagas. From the first millennium itself, Hinduism began taking root. In fact, the name Kashmir itself comes from a word called word which means a lake which was drained out by someone called Rishi Kashyapa or the sage Kashyapa. So the first part of the word Kashmir comes from the name of the sage Kashyapa, and the second part Mir means a water body. So according to this ancient Hindu legend, Kashmir was a big water body which was drained by Rishi Kashyapa, and after this draining took place, it was inhabited by these sages. So after this Vedic period, Buddhism began taking root in Kashmir, and till the time Kanishka became the emperor, the fourth Buddhist council took place in the valley of Kashmir, in a place called Harwan, which is not very far away from the capital city, Srinagar. And from there onwards, because Kashmir lay on what would later be called as the Silk Route, Buddhism began to be imported into China and the surrounding areas. So between the 8th and the 13th century, a form of Hinduism called Shaivism, which consists of worshipping Lord Shiva, was prominent in Kashmir. And from the 13th century onwards, Islam began taking roots within the socio-political milieu of Kashmir. Geopolitically, Kashmir rests between three great superpowers. There's China on the north, there's Pakistan on the west, and there's India down south. So that also gives its geopolitical importance.
All right. So would you like to talk a little bit about Maharaja Hari Singh and his role much later, around 1947, a little before 1947 as well? Because a lot of us know that Maharaja Hari Singh was a big pivotal personality around that time, but we don't know why he was a pivotal personality. Can you tell us a
little bit
about
that
him?
Aspect of history, we'd have to go back a little bit. So, as I told you, the Kashmir region was inhabited by Hindus and later by Buddhists. And the first Muslim rulers of Kashmir were whom we call the Shahmir dynasty. So Shahmir was the first convert to Islam. And from that point onwards, Kashmir was progressively ruled by the native Kashmirs in the form of Shahmirs, then the Chak dynasty. Akbar, the Mughal emperor, he, by deceitful means, he got Yusuf Shah Chak incarcerated, and he began ruling Kashmir. After the Mughals, it was the Afghans who closely followed at their heels who ruled Kashmir for the better part of a century or so. And right after the decline of the Afghans, there was the Sikh rule, who also ruled Kashmir for quite an appreciable amount of time. The region of Kashmir was sold by the Britishers to the Sikhs, which is called the Treaty of Amritsar. So from that point onwards began the rule of Sikhs, which later degenerated into a local rule called the Dogra rule. The Dogra rule begins with the rule of Maharaja Gulab Singh. So Maharaja Gulab Singh, from his progeny, sprang another rulers, primarily Hari Singh and Pratap Singh. So come 1947, which is the time when India and Pakistan were partitioned and when these countries gained their freedom, Kashmir was being ruled by a Dogra ruler called Maharaja Hari Singh. Now, Hari Singh was Hindu and a majority of his subjects were Muslims. So therein began the confusion of the partition times, because the majority would have liked to go towards Pakistan, but Maharaja Hari Singh, being a Hindu, he acceded to India, which according to many observers was blatantly against the choices of most of his subjects.
Now that we have just crossed about 1947, around the time of 1947, Maharaja Hari Singh is also known for signing the instrument of accession with the then Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru. Can you tell us a little bit about the instrument of accession?
On the eve of the partition of the subcontinent, when India and Pakistan gained their freedom, there were some entities called the princely states. So these princely states were ruled by independent rulers, and they were given the choice to accede either to India or Pakistan. Among them, Hyderabad, Junagadh, and Kashmir, prime examples. So in 1947, when Pakistan was partitioned off from India, there was a ongoing movement against Maharaja Hari Singh, led by Sheikh Abdullah, who was a charismatic leader of the Party of National Conference. So, on the eve of the partition, Kashmir witnessed a annexation attempt by Pakistan. The Pakistanis, in connivance with Muslim rebels of the district of Poonch, sent in a raiding party of the tribals of Northwestern Frontier Province. So the idea of the Pakistani administration was that Kashmir must be very vulnerable at this point in time. So it's better that we attack it and, you know, annex it. But to their utter dismay, Maharaja Hari Singh, when faced with this aggression of the tribal raiding parties from Pakistan, he went to seek help from the Indian Union, which led to the signing of a document called the Instrument of Accession. So with regards to the clauses of this Instrument of Accession, the Maharaja, he agreed to give up some of his powers, mainly related to protection, defense, and foreign currency and communications. In return for this, the Indian Union promised him immediate aid in fending away the aggression from the Pakistani side. So as a result, the Indian troops were flown in October 1947, and they were very successful in containing this attack by the Pakistanis. And as a result, the Indian troops came to be stationed permanently in the area of Jammu and Kashmir. The raiding parties were not very popular themselves. They started by committing rapes. They did manage to reach the doorsteps of Srinagar up to Baramulla district, but they were held there by the Indian forces. And ultimately, this proved to be a failed experiment on the side of Pakistan. Maharaja Hari Singh, after signing the instrument of accession, he fled the state and an interim government was set up.
So in regards to, say, the conflict that had persisted because of the 1947 partition and the accession to the Indian state or instrument of accession. So the United Nations Security Council Resolution number 47 in 1948 mediated that a plebiscite be conducted in Kashmir. However, this did not take place. Can you just highlight the reasons why this did not take place and the effects, just to clarify, and what the difference is between a plebiscite and a referendum?
As I told you, in 1947, the Maharaja of Jammu and Kashmir, he sought help from the Indian government in fending away the aggression from Pakistan. So India approached the United Nations in 1948 to seek their intervention in solving this issue. So the United Nations passed a resolution, the resolution number 47, wherein they stated that the problem of Kashmir should be solved in a peaceful manner, and it should begin with India withdrawing all its troops, followed by Pakistan withdrawing all its citizens who had come as a part of the raiding parties, etc., and a plebiscite being held in the region of Kashmir, wherein the local population would decide which side they want to be with. So it's interesting to know that India went to the United Nations, and this resolution was passed under chapter number 6, which deals with peacetime resolution and not wartime resolution. So a referendum and a plebiscite are two ways of knowing the will of the local population in an indirect democracy. If you want to know what the people are siding with, there are two ways of knowing it in a democracy. You can either use the representatives that the people have already elected, or you can go back to the people and ask them directly. So a plebiscite is a wider word. So when you are conducting a plebiscite, you are deciding on a constitutional question, going to the people and asking them directly. And when you are doing a referendum, you might be striking down a law, or you might be, you know, passing a fresh law. So a plebiscite answers a bigger question, like adopting a constitution, and a referendum is regarding a smaller question of a law within that constitution. So the Kashmir issue is related to the conduction of a plebiscite, wherein people need to be asked, or should be asked, which side they want to go with, India, Pakistan, or complete independence. But the fact of the matter is, after the passing of this resolution in 1948, India and Pakistan did not do the relevant things that would have led to the conduction of this plebiscite. India did not demilitarize the area. Pakistan did not restore the pre-1947 situation, and as a result, the plebiscite has never been conducted.
India and Pakistan both did not take any relevant actions, as you said, that would lead to a plebiscite happening in Kashmir. But that could be for many political reasons. But after the partition, after 1947, there have been a few wars and countless ceasefire violations and skirmishes between India and Pakistan on the Kashmiri border. and as many people have told me, and as one might hear from the news, these ceasefire violations happen very frequently. Can you tell us the condition after the UN Security Council resolution, and the condition right now, and the condition after the wars? What was the effect of all these wars?
One must understand that the identity of the subcontinent is mainly determined by the religion that the people of an area follow. So Pakistan has been very aggressive in demanding that Kashmiris belong to them, or Kashmir belongs to them. So Pakistan has tried always to annex or capture Kashmir, resulting beginning with symmetric warfare. Pakistan experimented with symmetric warfare in 1947, in 1965, and even in 1971 or 1999. And between these experimentations with symmetric warfare, when the symmetric warfare has failed, Pakistan has resorted to asymmetric warfare, which took the form of training guerrillas and starting a guerrilla campaign and training young men to pick up arms against the Indian administration. So the first of these wars, as I said, began in 1947, which did not lead to any concrete result. After 1947, Pakistan decided on a covert operation, which was called the Operation Gibraltar, to annex Kashmir. For some reasons that could not materialize, which resulted in the 1965 skirmishes between India and Pakistan. These skirmishes led to a full-blown war. After the 1965 war, in which Pakistan did not make any sizable, they could not take any part of the Kashmir region. They tried it again in 1971, because in 1971, former East Pakistan, which is now called Bangladesh, they started a freedom movement. They wanted a separate state. They wanted their region to have an independent existence. So as a result, India had to intervene in the East Pakistan revolt, which also resulted in opening up of different fronts, including Kashmir. And as a result of the 1971 East Pakistan war, where Pakistan shamefully had to surrender, the Indian government grew in confidence. And seeing the fact that they are unable to defeat India in symmetric warfare, Pakistan stopped this experiment and started the ploy of training young armed men, a fact which was reinforced after the Soviet experiment in Afghanistan, where Pakistan, with the help of Americans, trained armed guerrillas. And after the wrapping up of the Afghan-Soviet war, these armed guerrillas were also pushed into Kashmir. The final manifestation of the symmetric warfare experimentation by Pakistan came in 1999, wherein Pakistan tried to capture some of the peaks in the Kargil region in the winters, which led to a battle called the Kargil Battle. In fact, this Kargil war was seminal in altering the administration within Pakistan itself, because General Pervez Musharraf, who had started this battle, he ultimately defeated or ousted the Pakistani Prime Minister in a coup and became the dictator and then the president. So this is a brief history of the wars between India and Pakistan. And between the wars of 1971 and 1999, Pakistan changed its approach to Kashmir and started asymmetric warfare, which resulted in a full-blown insurgency in Kashmir.
That's actually very interesting, but you can't but to some extent, India has been heavy-handed in the ways it has been dealing with Kashmir and Kashmiris. And one of the instances of its heavy-handed behavior is the election rigging that happened in 1987. And again, the emphasis on the fact that it is only one of the instances of heavy-handedness. Can you just tell us more about this election rigging and why it was a pivotal moment
so
in Kashmir at the time?
Kashmir has primarily been a single-party system, wherein the Indians thought that they could tightly control the local politics by patronizing a single party, which was the National Conference. National Conference had a legacy, and because of its contribution in fighting against the autocratic rule of the Maharaja, it had gained widespread popularity. So the politics in Kashmir was dominated by National Conference. The topmost leader of National Conference, Sheikh Abdullah, he was first given a chance to form the government, but then he was very brazenly incarcerated in 1953, resulting in his ousting and the placement of one of his comrades, Bakshi Ghulam Mohammad, at the helm of affairs. And he was incarcerated for 20 odd years. So his incarceration created a political gap within Kashmir, which led to the breaking up of National Conference into two entities. One, which was called the Plebiscite Front, who were demanding the conduction of a plebiscite that the UN resolution had promised, and another one, National Conference. So in 1974, Indira Gandhi, she signed an accord with Sheikh Abdullah and released him. With the promise of him making him the CM. What she wanted to do, in fact, was tightly control the politics of Jammu and Kashmir through Sheikh Abdullah. Things were pretty normal between 1974 and 1982, 1983, the year when Sheikh Abdullah passed away, because he had such a cult following in the region that any decision he took had the backing of the people. In 1982-83, after the passing away of Sheikh Abdullah, his son, Farooq Abdullah, came to head the party, whose government was also summarily dismissed by the Indian Union. And this unpopular measure of summarily dismissing an elected government resulted in resentment in Kashmir. After his government was dismissed, he was forced to sign in a agreement with the Indian National Congress. So the Kashmiris took this as a betrayal of their trust of having been forced to sign a accord with an entity that had dismissed a popular government. So in 1987, this resentment came to fore with the formation of a political entity called the MUF, or Muslim United Front. Muslim United Front was an amalgamation of Muslim organizations that took the decision of contesting elections in Kashmir to prove that they were leading. But unfortunately, the 1987 elections, according to many international observers as well, were rigged. And in fact, some political commentators have observed that MUF would have won more than 20 seats. And because of the brazen rigging of the 1987 elections, MUF lost. And the foremost of MUF, or the Muslim United Front, they became the precursors in the formation of the first separatist organization, the JKLF, Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front. And after the rigging of the 1987 elections, internationally, this was the period when the Afghanistan region was coming out of the Soviet war. Pakistan also diverted its attention towards Kashmir, and the Afghan militia who had fought the USSR, they were diverted towards Kashmir. And from 1987 onwards, these two factors, international geopolitics and the rigging of local elections and the political resentment that had been brewing from 1983 onwards, these three factors, they came together to form the insurgency, or to result in the insurgency that ultimately started in the summer of 1989.
How has this insurgency in a Kashmir affected militarization on everyday life, especially on the average Kashmiri and society?
Starting 1989, young men beginning with the JKLFs, or the Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Fronts, now famous Haji group, which consisted of four people. It had Hamid Sheikh, it had Yasin Malik, it had Ashfaq Majid, and it had Javed Mir. So beginning with these four people, young men started to cross over into Pakistan to receive arms training. By 1990s, there were at least 20,000 men, armed men, who were ready to take the violent path in order to oust Indian military from the region. This insurgency, full-blown insurgency, resulted in India resorting to brutal tactics. A measure which resulted in more people joining the insurgents. Beginning with the militarization of the area, the militarization of police, and hard measures, there were crackdowns on civilian areas where whole civilian populations would be driven out of their homes to conduct door-to-door checks. There would be mass arrests, and there would be incarcerations without the proper judicial process. So all of this resulted in a lot of resentment within the people. And Kashmir became one of the most highly militarized zone. In fact, according to some observers, the most militarized zone in the world. This has resulted in the brutalization of a large segment of population, because even the civilian areas have been converted into garrisons. So wherever you go in the region, there are gun toting soldiers, and there's definitely no difference between a civilian area and an army area. To top this, the construction of army barracks in all civilian areas to stop the movements of the insurgents also restricted the free movement of the civilians. And the order of the administration that no person can move around without having a proper ID card on him, it also curbed the freedom of movement. All these, resulted in the accumulation of resentment, which ultimately is continuing to this day.
So just seeing a lot of uniformed men with assault rifles walking around is what has brutalized
there are
the
a lot
public
of factors
in Kashmir, is what you're saying, right?
To begin with, let me give an example. There are incidences when the soldiers and the insurgents would, fight. There would be cross firings, or there would be standoffs, or there would be skirmishes. This would ultimately result in the brutalization of the common people, because after the skirmish ended, the people who had to bear the brunt were the common people, and they would bear the brunt from both the sides of the insurgents and the forces as well. To top that, all the houses in which the insurgents would be hiding would be blown up. So that also resulted in a lot of resentment. To top that all, anybody who was suspected would be arrested on mere suspicion, and they might have had to go long periods of incarceration without any proper judicial process. And in addition to these, the passing of a few draconian laws like the AFSPA, or the Armed Forces Special Powers Act, or the Disturbed Areas Act, or the Public Safety Act, which basically empowers the security forces to arrest or even kill anybody, they also resulted in the growth of a lot of resentment. And as a result of collateral damage between skirmishes between the insurgents and the security forces, common civilians were killed, which also resulted in resentment. And lately, from 2008 onwards, the use of brutal tactics on peaceful protesters, which has resulted in the killing, maiming, and blinding of many young people, has also added to this resentment as well.
So India has had the highest number of internet shutdowns in the world, and Kashmir is that one region in India where most shutdowns happen. For the listeners who aren't familiar with internet shutdowns, an internet shutdown is when a geographical region, such as a small village, town, district, a set of districts, or a state, has been deliberately cut off from the internet. And last year alone in Kashmir, there were 2018, there were 134 internet shutdowns, maybe more. And this year, so far, there have been 41 internet shutdowns. In comparison, Pakistan had only 19 shutdowns between January 2016 and May 2018. That's almost, that's 2.5 years and just 19 shutdowns. And Syria and Egypt, being dictatorships, had only 8 and 3 shutdowns, respectively. And the longest internet shutdown observed in Kashmir in 2016, due to the agitation caused by the killing of Burhan Wani on 8th July 2016. And mobile internet services were suspended for about 133 days. Imagine not having internet for 133 days or restricted access to the internet. Can you tell us your on-the-ground experience of these shutdowns and how it affects the lives of Kashmiris and economic activity?
So, as I already mentioned, beginning with 2008, mass protests started erupting on the streets of Srinagar, wherein hundreds of thousands of people would just assemble on the streets to take out peaceful protests. So this resulted in the killing of a large number of young men and women and the blinding and maiming of many others. So from 2008 onwards, there has been this consistent argument within the administrative circles in Kashmir that internet is one of the tools that is helping people to, you know, assemble and people to organize these type of protests. So this has especially become accentuated after the advent of social media platforms. So to curb these protests or to stop people from assembling or to stop people from expressing their opinion on social media platforms after an important incident, like you mentioned, the killing of a guerrilla commander, Burhan Wani, the Indian government has resorted to the curbing of internet. So there are a couple of ways in which they do this. After the killing of a militant commander, when the administration expects the eruption of a protest, they would just pull down the switch on internet. That means the internet goes off for as many days as they want it to be. And when it is resorted, it is resorted to a minimal speed, so that no video or audio can be shared. Number two, the internet in specific areas is blocked. See, if there's a problem in a particular area where protests might take place or where people might assemble after a certain incident, to curb the spread of the news regarding the incident, internet is, you know, switched off. And it usually happens for at least 4 to 5 days. Lately, the Kashmir region had begun to come out of the long dark area of desperation, which had resulted because of the insurgency. And one of the ways in which Kashmiris were making progress was by the resurgence of economic activity. So this economic activity was mainly fueled by the internet. So these internet shutdowns have not only had a effect on the common masses vis-a-vis freedom of speech, it has actually led to the led to a situation where the economic activity of the people of Jammu and Kashmir is severely impacted. One should appreciate the fact that the state of Jammu and Kashmir lies in the Himalayas. It's a far-flung state, so one cannot travel so easily. The only road that connects Jammu and Kashmir to the rest of the Indian subcontinent almost means closed through to the minimum of 100 days a year because of snowfall, rain or landslides. So the internet serves a serves a big purpose, and the curbing down of internet also results in other problems like children who have to appear in exams or people who have to fill up job applications, and even people who have to travel, because if the internet is down and you want to book a ticket, you cannot do it. So yeah, it has become a norm, shutting down the internet. But the argument from the administration is that it prevents the deaths on the streets.
So oftentimes in conflict zones, the people are the ones that suffer the consequences of war and systematic oppression, as discussed. Their consensus is often ignored. So for our final question, I ask, what do Kashmiris want?
I think right now the Kashmiris want peace. I think they see the future as a peaceful buffer state between the entities of India, Pakistan, and China. Most of the Kashmiris would have wanted freedom a decade back. But seeing the brutalization that has come with asking for their political rights, the thing that every Kashmiri immediately wants is primarily demilitarization, depoliticization of the issue, and the restoration of basic human rights, beginning with, you know, ending of these draconian laws, and the ending of the freedoms, like we spoke about, the curbing down of internet. So yeah, I think demilitarization and restoration of peace would be the thing that Kashmiris want most at the moment.
All right. Thanks a lot for being on our podcast. We truly respect the time that you've given us. Thanks a lot for it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being our guest.
That's it for this episode of the Smart Power Podcast. Thanks for listening to the Smart Power Podcast with Akash and Tal. Please consider rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts and following or subscribing to our podcast on whichever app you listen. And most importantly, share this podcast with whoever you think will be interested in it. Your brother, sister, mother, father, distant relative sitting in the Philippines, pen pal in Uruguay, your pet dog Dory, everybody. If you listen to our podcast on Anchor, you can leave us a voice message, a message through the app, and we might feature you in our next episode. If you want to share anything with us, feedback, an episode topic, or whatever, excluding spam, you can email us at thesmartpowerpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening again, and this is Akash
and Tal
signing off.